Namaste and in Lakech, and welcome to this week's episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and our guest this week is an interesting fellow. His name is Christoph Morrow. He has had some really interesting cycles and circles in life so far, and having to deal with some challenges, and we'll get into those in a little bit. He served in the Navy. He's written a book called The Sacred Son.
The Second Son, sorry.
The Second Son.
Yes. Yeah.
Didn't have my readers on. Right?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Hey, maybe it's better. The Sacred Son, right? Yeah, exactly. Son, yeah. And also was engaged in the film industry for a bit in his younger years too, and has had some challenges with Tourette's. And so we're going to have a really interesting talk about the inner dive and how he found himself. Christoph, glad to have you here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, you know, when you were younger, most of all my guests have had some kind of inner experience when they were young, or you know, teenage, midlife, that got them connected with their inner self. Now, as you were growing up, that's had to have been a little different journey in having to deal with a situation that you weren't necessarily prepared for.
No.
That it was just part of you, right?
Yeah.
So how did you initially work through that or find yourself and get comfortable with the fact that you are who you are, right?
I think that sometimes that reality is imposed on you. It is like relentlessly beaten into you, like who you are or who they think you are, or they mock who you're trying to be, right?
From the exterior view. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I remember the most, I think the most sort of profound and solemn realization I had was when I was about 6 years old. That was my first one. When I was, my dad had, he had beaten me for something really ridiculous. And I don't even know what it was, but it was he's really violent.
Mm.
And I was out in the front yard, and I was by myself, and I was crying, and I told myself that I would never treat my children that way.
Why would anyone treat their children that way? That's just horrible.
Yeah.
And yet it happens. And I, you know, mm-hmm. unfortunately in your situation, it happened to you. Mm. So in that realization that you'd never treat your own kids that way, how did you situate yourself in relationship to what was going on with your father? How did you deal with that internally?
The trouble is that trauma can, like what I said before, it imparts paranoia and anxiety and mistrust.
Extreme.
Well, yeah. If you have, if you're symptomatic of other mental illness, such as ADHD and OCD, this trauma like exacerbates that, and it's like a positive feedback loop. They both feed each other, and you become more and more dysfunctional like with other people, because you can't, there's no orbit of normalcy that's ever been established. You have nothing to gravitate.
Sure. Well, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but we tend to want to analyze, diagnose, and treat with pharmaceuticals rather than actually get to know what's going on inside the individual.
I think that it has to be a holistic approach. You have to have, mm-hmm. because what happens is that, I think that a lot of people can like shortcut straight to that. But yeah, yes, contextually, your life can be such that like it ends up inducing like these really terrible stuff. Like for me, I was living, when I was writing my book, I wrote my book almost in total isolation for 2 years. And then I was living in COVID.
I have to say, that's probably kind of enjoyable for some, right?
No, it was not for me. I did not do well. And I kind of lost my mind. And I lost my marriage, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was, you know, I for a long time, I wanted to leave. But we ended up staying. And I, And after she left, I moved to Vancouver, and now I feel much better because I'm around people, and I have loads of people to talk to. And it wasn't like that. It was completely different when I lived way out in the country by myself. And
And all you had to do was talk to yourself. That can get you into trouble, can't it? How did that transition? What was it like? Now that you mentioned the isolation, if you don't mind, and I'm sure you've gone through this enough times, and you've got a real wonderful attitude towards vulnerability. How did you work through that? What were the things that in that isolation brought up the initial activities of the separation that occurred?
I think that the most important quality is to be, you have to be honest with yourself, because I'm sorry, hold on. You asked me a question, but I was trying to,
That's okay. Go ahead and
I already
answer
had an,
that.
I had an answer, but now I can't remember what it was because I was, I, okay. Well, sorry. What was your question initially?
Well, the question was, what was it like internally to in that process of recognizing your situation, the separation that was happening, and the angst that you were feeling in that isolation?
I'm sorry.
Does
I'm
that make
confused.
sense?
No, I'm really okay. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not getting it. Okay, so I
What
don't
was
really.
it like in the process of realizing that, oh, this separation is occurring and I need to work through it somehow?
Well, I realized that my ADHD and OCD and a number of other symptoms like were exacerbating my anxiety and paranoia towards people. I had become something of an agoraphobe because of my isolation, and so my and it remained me. It gave me a realization that people that live out in the country. I grew up in the country. I was raised on a farm for the first 9 years of my life, and so like I'm these are my people, right? I know th they. I, they get paranoid and they become kind of aggressive and agitated around people, and you can see that when they go into town. Like I because I've lived in these towns before, and you go to the feed store where they have all the farm equipment, and everybody goes there because it's a local business and it's kind of big. And anyway, yeah, and you can kind of see like them interact, and it's real guarded. You can kind of tell it's a very guarded situation. It's almost like they're discussing the front lines of something, right? And every time they're talking, right? So it's really
Well, unless you have an intimate relationship or
not
well-established
what
relationship with others, there often is that guardedness.
yeah, and that's the thing though. It's more pronounced is what. And so anyway, I realized that you have to you really have to destroy your habits of thinking, because you're going to like in the you're going to spiral in some sense emotionally, and form bad emotional thinking habits, and you
But
have to.
mostly self-deprecating, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We've got something like 70,000 thoughts a day, and with folks like you, maybe even more. And the majority of them are self-deprecated when you're in that kind of cyclic activity. So how did you destroy your stinking thinking about yourself?
So here's the thing. I don't think you're like it's one of those things like I discovered, I think, when I was in my early 20s, I was talking, I saw someone on the internet that said it was an older man. He said he was in his 60s, or say he was in his 70s, and he said he didn't understand why his father did to him what he did. And then I realized in that moment that you never get over it. Whatever happens to you in your life, you're never, ever, ever, ever going to get over it. There's a thing called in therapy called radical realization. You probably, of course, you probably know about that. And radical acceptance. And radical acceptance, you're supposed to like look at the like total end, the end, the absolute end of your situation. Mm-hmm. And or like, for example, like if you accept that one day the planet's going to be caught up in a asteroid storm and the whole thing's gone, if you accept that and it could sometimes alleviate anxiety in the present, there's something else also I learned: you shouldn't borrow grief from the future.
Right. That's the theory of being, you know, false evidence appearing real. We spend our time either in the future or the past worrying about what we did do and how the consequences and what we might do and what those consequences are. And it takes you out of the moment. Mm-hmm. That's really where the power is, because we, you know, we're kind of in this eternal now. Mm-hmm. And by being in that place, the radical acceptance tends to alleviate those fears and constrictions that we feel internally, the anxiety. Mm-hmm. Right? How did that work for you? Because I find this really intriguing, because you've hit on a really important part of self-transformation.
Yeah, well, radical acceptance, like you just said, it's about seeing the end, but like whenever you are describing like the concept, like if you there's a couple of things that I do. Number one, I do meditation, of course. Like, meditation is critical to do at least once a day, every day forever. Because the way I describe it is that anxiety is like in a giant pool, and meditation is like emptying it with a garden hose. You see? It's going to take a long time.
Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah. It's going to take a long time, but eventually it happens. It's reliable, too. Mm-hmm. And so...
my own experience as well. I'll validate that.
Yeah. Deep breathing exercises, of course. There's one thing that I learned was that tapping, I don't know if you've heard of that, if anyone in the audience hasn't heard of that, but yeah. Like you,
EFT.
You tap a bundle of nerves or something or somewhere, like, yeah. You do that. I do that in deep breathing simultaneously. And that is like a superpower of like anxiety relief. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Having output is probably the most important quality to any of that. You have to have output. You have to be generating something, goodness. You have to be part of the world that you live in. You have to be part, the most important. See, the thing
you've
about
got to interact.
Yeah, the thing about relationships, like, is that back in the day, they say the ideal village size, community size, is 200 people, and that would produce, that ends up producing the most democratic situation, mm-hmm. right? I think, which is kind of fair to say, but the purpose of that is like to generate a greater closeness, because then people within your community become different supports for different things. When I was living in isolation, my ex-wife, she was my everything. She had to be everything because I didn't have anyone else to talk to.
Right.
And that's a really unhealthy dynamic.
Nobody can fulfill 100% of the roles you need, right?
That's right. And so she didn't share in that, because she could go to work. She was going like to different countries. And so, you know, anyway, so it's important, I think, to look for people that you can confide in, to become member to your network of support, because it really is, there really is something about, a lot of people talk about their political beliefs, and the thing is that I don't know if they're actually consistent with what they would really actually do. And so the problem, I think it's important.
That's a really honest view.
Yeah. So to hear, so when you hear someone say, when you hear someone say, that they're this or that, and then the next moment they're like, hey, you want to go get some vanilla ice cream? You know, you need to realize that people are flawed and nuanced, and that
we're all imperfect human beings.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And, you know, even with I'm also the operations director, co-director for a global peace movement called Live and Let Live. And we've got two principles, a moral and a legal. The moral is be an excellent human. Well, what does that really mean? Well, that gives us the opportunity to talk about it, right? And to discover what that really is. And then the legal side of things is don't aggress. And our long-term goal is to remove aggression from the law. Now, that's a really minuscule part of the population that's going to be willing to step up to do that. However, the majority of us can learn how to get along better, right?
Yeah, and I think that most people do. They want to. The trouble is that really, truly, ADHD is so powerful. It's a very potent force for exacerbating your anxiety towards people. One of the things that I noticed when I was able to finally slow down after doing meditation, I always do my meditation, and doing my work as a writer. We were just talking about, oh gosh.
So meditation,
ADHD,
education, and manuscripts, huh?
I was talking about ADHD.
Your mind in that situation, and regardless of the label, there's a section of the population that really thinks fast, and so fast that it's hard to keep up with yourself, and you're analyzing the things around you way more than normal. Now, part of that I see as an advantage.
I think it's
and the normies, right, that don't do that, it's like, oh man, you're so intense, can't deal with you. However, you know, that to me, that's a gift.
The trouble is that, like, the thing is that it can't be moderated. So yeah, it's a very powerful river, right? So but the thing is that you can't get across all the time. Right. So that's,
yeah, you hop on a raft and it often gets torn asunder across, right?
And so the thing that I noticed when I finally was able to slow down enough is I noticed how much anxiety other people have. And when you realize that, there's a certain measure of comfort, I think, that's imparted to you, because it's important to be mindful, like, because people often get stuck in their own heads and they think about their own anxiety. They think that everyone can see them and everyone's thinking the same thing.
Right.
Everyone's thinking the exact same thing everywhere we go. They're either indifferent or they feel that way generally. It's so important to get outside of yourself, I think, and try to observe people in a way that's more compassion-based rather than fear-based.
Absolutely. Totally agree with that. And it gives you the opportunity to just reflect more and find a center and maybe even ask some questions.
Yeah. Managing emotions with ADHD is probably one of the biggest challenges, because because I have Tourette's. I also have, my brain's deformed. My ability to restrain myself is even further depreciated. So with ADHD, you already have that problem. With Tourette's, it's even worse. You know, like, so I mean, imagine, because I mean, it's manifest. I mean, you can actually see it. I cannot stop myself from saying certain things and doing certain things. So anyway,
sure. That's got to be from a personal perspective in the self-judgment arena. That's got to be a challenge, right? Because you're in that place and you're looking at yourself through the eyes of others and wanting to adjust, and yet being in that critical self place, which doesn't really help, right? How do you get through that? How do you move from having those internal perturbations to finding something that is more compatible in that navigation of conversation and relationships?
Sorry, hold on. I started to get the first half, but then I didn't understand the second.
I apologize, I realize I'm feeding you a long form instead of short form for you to digest a little better. So in the how do you adjust in the moment to honor the reflection of others and still be in center in yourself?
It's a bit of a silent handshake. It's a reciprocal thing. Like, you don't, it's something that you do willfully and without like them being party to it necessarily. So like you would,
well, sure, because you know you. They don't yeah. know you. They're just yeah. right.
Yeah, so it's important to think to in your head, if you start to feel an extreme way, like an extreme emotion in the context that does not really that where that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. It's important to learn to stop and walk away from the situation, because there is nothing more damaging to a relationship than saying something you don't really mean because of like a passing frustration.
Right, especially if it's an angry or frustrated one, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because you're going to say stuff that is probably going to be offensive.
Yeah. Know?
Yet it yeah. takes a special person to understand that. And most of us don't, right? We just take mm-hmm. people for face value. We don't look any further. And we just accept, you know, we don't try to understand, right? It's like, was it Stephen Covey's fifth insight or fifth principle of the, or habit? Understand first before being understood, right? Seek to understand the person. Well, that takes questions and time. And mm-hmm. patience, mm-hmm. right? And even for me, one of the things I've found, and I've had some, as a transformational coach, I've had clients with high anxiety, variety of reasons, some like yours. And one of the techniques that I've suggested that they try is just putting their fingertips together. And you might even try this, put your fingertips together and feel your heartbeat in them.
Yeah.
When you're operating on attempting to feel your heartbeat, mm-hmm. your mind's not as active.
Yeah, it's like sensory distraction. Like they do that yeah. Look at three things you can touch, three things you can smell, three things you can do all your senses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a grounding technique, right? Yeah, so
right.
Like,
it's just to get you out of your head, basically, exactly. And the heartbeat yeah. is a very functional. It's something you can depend on.
Yeah, right? It's interesting that they say that's the first instrument. That's really cool, huh?
Yeah,
the human heart. So cool.
Yeah, and it's beats that, you know, it's like a reflection of the universe. Universe has a pulse, right? It expands and it contracts. It's much slower, but it's been said there was a book called Biocosm that John Gardner wrote. It was a lawyer. And, you know, one of the things, you don't expect those kind of books to come out of lawyers.
Sure.
However, sure. he said in it that in his discoveries, it was like the universe is trying to replicate itself in each individual. And to see it from that place, the heartbeat is that first, the heartbeat, the breath. Right? We all have that.
Yeah, it's a kind of, it's an impermanent sentience. We are anyway. I think it's yeah. so cool. I think that's cool. Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. So how in this, I'm sure maybe in your processing of yourself and being able to find your center, what are some of the things you mentioned, the three items throughout the five senses that you focus on? Is that a process that brings you into a more a softer awareness of the moment rather than something so intense?
Yeah, because your anxiety is being triggered by something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something in the environment that you are associating with something from your past, something in your brain that says, uh-oh, something terrible is about to happen. Prepare yourself. Adrenaline. I feel like anxiety is almost like a byproduct of adrenaline or something, because it seems
Yeah,
like it
which
just,
comes first?
right? No, well, I think it's definitely adrenaline, I think, because or well,
It depends on the trigger.
right.
If it's an instantaneous trigger that you're not
Yeah.
expecting, then you get a spike of adrenaline. If it's something that you're mulling over, then the anxiety may come first.
But maybe it's like having an earring, you know, like once you pierce your ear and then you got to keep it open. And it's like adrenaline is like the thing that keeps it open. You know what I mean? So it never lets it close. So it's like both, really. And one of them initiates, like you said, and then, but the other one, but eventually it's like they sustain one another.
Sure. And you've got to learn to take that dance to a different tune.
It's important. Self-awareness is a great habit. The problem is that you can, of course, take it to the extreme and become really insecure. And I, like me, that's what happened to me. I almost didn't form an identity, basically, because I was so busy trying to understand other people, and like the notion of me was being beaten out of me every day. So it's like,
Sure, because you didn't get any chance for any
yeah, like
reflection, right? You have
for
got to
example,
be able to have a conversation to say, hey, I'm feeling this way. How's it, what's your experience like?
For the first time, I'm 34 years old. I'm actually bothering to decorate the space that I live in. Because I actually feel somewhat like I have an identity now, and that I want to express that, and I've never felt the safety or security to do that before. And it's a funny thing. It's a funny thing because I didn't do that growing up at all. I have nothing on my walls. I never did. Never have done anything with my space. It's always been bare, like I was an inmate.
Well, and it would stand to reason that because of what you were going through, I would think that you were pretty empty most of the time and just bereft of connection. So why would you want to place things around you that might offer connection? Because in the situation that you were in, that would get severed fairly quickly. What you've said so far in that trauma-filled childhood.
Yeah, and it was also like I also was so transient in that sense, like I couldn't like anything, because if I liked something and I got made fun of for it, then it was like, so it was hard for me. So it, I the, I th I feel like it was perfect for the ingredients of making a writer.
Oh, yeah.
Because I
Very
have
introspective, right?
yeah so like yeah because I date I've been on a million dates now, and but at all the girls that I have a they say I'm really, really, really self-aware, which is a really which everyone generally thinks is an admirable trait. The trouble is that I take it to like extreme, and
It's really tough to be around as another person unless you are self-aware and you have those. We had a prelim conversation, and I'd mentioned my wife, and we have those kind of conversations. We're both extremely self-aware, and when we think we aren't, and even when we think we are, we talk about it. And having those conversations can either attract or repel, depending on how vulnerable the other person can be to self-reveal in truth and be
Yeah,
authentic.
people don't like to it's so you just make an excellent point. It's really, really, really important to recognize that if you're a person that's trying to make themselves like it to reveal themselves to other people and to be vulnerable to other people, that's incredibly brave.
Absolutely.
That's not coward. That's not like you being vulnerable as it you laying down and letting them do
Or
whatever.
weird
It's
or
you saying,
crazy or any of those kinds of labels that
it's you going into
tend to
war
put
without
on you,
armor.
right?
That's what it is. It's you
Yeah.
going into war without armor. It's not you laying down and surrendering. So when you
Well, they
say
say
making
that
yourself
perfect
vulnerable.
love, in imperfect love, there is no fear, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, how does that fit? Because in what you're saying you do, you're in a place of self-love where you're recognizing yourself and saying, okay, this is me authentically.
Well, I had to have a lot of validation, and I had to have the right validation. My the work that I do, I write. My work is epic fantasy. My book, The Second Son. However, I am married to the notion of literature and prose, and writing something that endures forever. Because I mean, that's what
trivial
I
mean. Stuff won't do it.
Yeah, I can't just write stuff that's poppy and popular and doesn't challenge anything. I think it's funny because I keep seeing stuff about artists that about how they're asking a lot of people to conform and make a lot more money that way. But being an artist is about challenging all of that stuff and about
it's never about money.
My book, I price the paperback and the Kindle as low as possible in every market, all over in Amazon, everywhere. And then I put the hardcover at like $39.99, which is still a modest price. That's the only one that I make money from. And I do that because I consider it what I did a cultural contribution, I feel like.
And I did the same thing. I've got a paying it forward page on my website that I offer, I don't know, maybe half of the books that I've written. I've got 31 titles on Amazon.
Wow.
And I'm, looking for more, that there are more to come. It's fun to write though, isn't it?
It's the most
it's intense
thing in the entire thing in the world. I've never done anything with more love. In fact, the way I describe it is that I love writing more than the sum of my love for all other things.
So it has this, for me anyway, this may happen for you too. There's a certain catharsis as you're putting your thoughts to paper. You're processing what you're writing.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that you have to like. It is a catharsis, but you got to bleed. You know, that catharsis comes out in blood, right? Because you have
right.
to.
Yeah, metaphorically, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you have to, because like, for example, I wrote a short story the other day within my book. It's like a world building thing, but there's a guy who's an admiral, whatever. His son is a ship's captain. His son is kidnapped amidst a battle, and then he never finds him. His son was enslaved and taken away. He never sees him again. 20 years later, the admiral shows up to a random place, a port somewhere, different part of the world, and he sees what looks like his son. And he finds out his son was dropped off there recently by the guy who enslaved him, because his son had gotten a giant head injury and was like basically lost his ability to do anything for himself. And that's how he finds his son 20 years later.
Wow.
And then, yeah, so he's got to take it back. That's the kind of, that's my book is full of that. That's all different kinds of stories like that. I have another one, a little boy who goes, they're having a big party for this knight who's just getting knighted. And a little boy that's running through the kitchen, he's delivering messages. He grabs a bun, runs out. Turns out the food was poisoned. And the only reason they find out is because the boy had stolen the food. He eats it and dies. In front of everybody. This is still like, there are a lot of little stories. But the point is that, it's meant to describe, because I think you have to be comprehensive if you mean to.
Exactly. This is fascinating, you know, because you take that kind of investigation, contemplation to a whole new level of really deep emotional and impactful situations that most of us don't have. And because of that, we still operate on a very cursory level in life. How do you, acknowledging that, let's validate that, you know, and this is what I see as well, and my wife and I have conversations about this quite often, is that, you know, there's this superficial way of living that we don't truly open ourselves and or up to others in the living of our lives. You know, we've got the the blinders, or we've got tunnel vision as far as where we're going, what we want, our desires, what, you know, all those kinds of things. And we don't really think about others in the process. And yet we can't achieve any of that without engaging others. That's kind of a paradox and conundrum, if you will. It's like, you know, and that cognitive dissonance that takes place inside of us as far as wanting to do the right thing, what we feel, like you've, right, you feel intensely, I'm sure, what the right thing is to do, even if it's not acceptable in the situation that you're in, right? Because you're dealing with different people and they all have mindsets and perspectives and, and views, worldviews that probably aren't anywhere close to yours, because their lives are different, right? So how do you step into that and share a different perspective that opens their minds up? And your writing absolutely does that, in that ability to contemplate a deep emotional wound that you've got to figure out how to heal.
Yeah. Well, I had, but I had a thought and then I heard the last part.
Trying to ramble sometimes.
So I don't remember what I was going to say.
No. It'll come back.
So, okay.
So what do you find it is, one of the salient points of people understanding others that have a faster mind?
Because that's what's happening. Who am I talking to? The people that have the faster
mind, or the other one? What would you suggest to others in learning how to navigate or to have conversations, even to have relationships with people that are, for lack of a better, highly functional,
neurodivergent,
and yet, you know, whether it's autism or
the thing is that it's a lot of it has to do with subverting self-destruction, which is kind of funny because the people with ADHD and stuff like that, it's impulsivity is really rough, so managing finances is really tough. For people with ADHD and a number of other qualities to your life that can be damaged, injured, wounded by your
you see life pretty fragilely, right?
Yeah,
you feel really fragile in addressing those situations because there is this prescriptive activity that you're supposed to engage. Paying the bills, of taking care of the finance, all of those kinds of things that you're, the kind of lifestyle that you're expected to live.
Yeah, it's really interesting that we have this, like it is so, it makes me really sad how much we make people conform to the fact that you have to like make enough money to be able to buy property to just to live, like you, otherwise you just die. Like we are literally coercing people, we're literally coercing people into, like, you either die homeless or you are a slave to a corporation. They say we have more slaves now than we ever have people in the history
unless of the world. You find a way to authentically be yourself and find a niche market that you can fit into. Now that, again, as you talked earlier, that's a frightening position to be in, because it's just you don't have the safety, so-called safety and security of a job, right, of having to report someplace, and then you get a paycheck for your time and all that kind of stuff. You're totally dependent on you. That would almost seem like, wow, you mean I'm free to be rather than to have to operate to somebody else's beat?
It would create too many independent people.
Right.
Can you imagine that many independent women? The world, they would take over the world, literally.
Oh, I'm hoping so. I'm really hoping so.
Fingers crossed, man. Fingers crossed, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it would be fantastic because
Yeah.
you would have much more of this, you know, like men are from Mars and women are from Venus, back to John Gray's stuff from long ago. Women have a much more global perspective. They know how to get along with each other and manage
Well,
tasks simultaneously because they've had to in raising families. It's built in. Guys aren't
well, it's
like
not,
that.
it's, I think that human beings generally are driven towards that middle that you're talking about between the genders that everyone sort of lives at, right? Where there's a kind of neutral state. And the
That's what
deep and
makes
the
sense,
deviation,
right? But
yeah, the
that's not
deviation.
necessarily what we're being, you know, structured to do so. We've been in a patriarchal system that doesn't honor what you were just talking about.
No, I don't want to say, but that's like, but that's the reality. That's how most people end up behaving. My contention, given the, I'm just given voting demographics historically, in different authoritarian regimes.
Sure.
My this is the way that I could that I parse out the different. So if there's 10 people in the world, three of them are would be like unrepentant fascists, authoritarians. It's just in, they are willing to kill. To have that ideology, whatever. Five out of 10 can be coerced into either side, either liberty or into fascism. And they're almost indifferent un until it affects them. That's five, half the people, half the population literally feels this way. They don't care until it bothers them. Two out of 10, the last two out of 10 are have democracy. They want democracy and liberty. Like they have those ideas that they believe in them and it's they're principled about them. Only one out of those 10, though, only half of those one out of the two are willing to fight for it. So
Yeah, well, then
it's
it would
yeah.
seem that if you were willing to fight for something and die for it, that means you would be willing to kill others, then you're putting yourself back into that first three category, right? Because
Yeah.
killing just doesn't make sense. I don't
Yeah,
care.
well, yeah, the thing is, it's like with the only thing that gives me pause is the paradox of tolerance, which is I mean, we see that happening,
Right.
literally, like before our eyes. Like we're allow, like if you allow, I this is the most alarming thing. Like whenever you hear, a developed nation's the leader of a developed nation, arguing with an abortion. Someone against abortion rights, and they're saying women shouldn't have agency, or people that could get pregnant, people shouldn't have agency in this sense. And the leader's first argument is, well, what if they're sexually assaulted? That should not be the first argument. The first argument should be women, people that can get pregnant have agency, period. That's
Exactly.
it. That's it. That should be the first thing they say and the only thing they say. But instead, now we're having to justify it with these
We're
extreme
putting our moral
situations. Like,
codes.
yeah, so you cannot allow them to push you into defending your position because the position is unimpeachable. The position is that pregnant people have agency, period.
That's the
That's it.
foundation of our global
Yeah.
peace movement, right?
It should give
You're
you power.
free.
Yeah.
You own your body, life, time, money, property, all those kinds of things, and nobody can tell you what to do with it. And by the same token, neither can you. Imagine if we had that freedom in society. It would seem like it could create chaos because you're going to have those nefarious characters that just, you know,
They
when
don't live in good faith, yeah.
right, but that can also be managed by how you decide, you know, the don't aggress, right? There are rules of order that take care of that. And we've got those. However, we've also got laws that allow aggression. You know, a country can go to war with another country, and the, you know, like, and we were so fortunate. It's one of the things that came up about John Kennedy recently. You know, he was the outlier. If it weren't for him, we may not have a world to live in right now.
Oh, yeah, the Cuban Missile
Because
Crisis.
the CIA and the military at that time wanted to do preemptive strikes in Cuba and Russia with nuclear weapons. How idiot. I mean, there's just idiocracy in that kind of thinking. Yet we still have some of that. It's gotten a little better.
Yeah.
But, you know, how could you even think that that would be a right thing to do? Because it's initiating an entire destruction of a planet at that point. Because everybody had, and especially now. So how do you feel that or think that we can get beyond that separative notion? And I know just based on what you talked about in your research and your study and the statistics, you know, you've done some really finely honed work with that, and I honor that. What do you think at least a potential solution is to move beyond that, that we might be able to initiate in society today?
Well, I'm trying to figure, it's hard to ask people to be proactive about something. About something whenever they have so many other sufferings going on. You know, like to incite change requires so much accidental coordination and true coordination. Like,
it's an interesting mix, isn't it?
If you think about the Montgomery bus strikes, that went on for months, okay? And that took the Black community coming together and having, they literally had like phone networks set up to like have like taxi cabs. So people that had cars were driving all around the city to pick people up in Montgomery to take them to work, because they were just trying to get the freaking bus, like they just to be able to ride the bus like normal people, like everybody else.
It was, right. And looking back on that now, all they wanted, we think, how could we as a population treat people like that?
The amount of it, the extreme though. I mean, if you consider like the amount of infrastructure and the amount of money, like think about the amount of time all of these people spent rather than developing themselves in other ways, which is that they were part of this incredible movement, of course, that ended up inspiring so much more of the civil rights movement, right? But there was a lot of money and time and a lot lost in creating that fraternity and in creating that order and in creating that equality. And
I love that example. So, did you have something else to say? Because I got to me, it's like, how might we do something like that? Because it seems to me, I could be wrong, but talking about those five, right? 50% of the population apathetic towards politics right now. They don't, you know, and obviously it appears that we're being.
Oh, I know what it is. I know what we have to do. We have to show the bodies of the people dying in mass shootings. That's it. That nothing changed in the United States in the civil rights movement until people saw news footage of what was happening to the people in the civil rights movements when they were being sprayed with fire hoses and being attacked with dogs and being beaten by police and being beaten by rioters that were against civil rights. Nothing changed until that happened. Until those people are shown what's, in fact, if you look at
it's the kind of a shock and awe thing, right?
If you look at the interviews of people that have survived mass shootings, invariably they have changed their minds on the whole gun rights issue. That it's nothing's going to change until that happens. Until we see that, that's nothing's going to change. And there's going to be a number of movements, but that's going to be one of them. That would be the most effective one. Mm-hmm. That would be the most effective one.
It's like the same adage can be applied towards pretty much anything. Change doesn't happen until the pain becomes so unbearable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that reflection of how, you know, how can we allow this treatment of others? How can we treat others in that way? And even the gun laws, you know, you can have responsible parties and gun ownership, maybe. You know, look at the countries, look at Japan. Right? No guns. And they're pretty much crime free.
Well, that's that they're not.
That
well, the thing is, Japan's that's a complicated situation. Japan's
it is.
Well, because Japan's like for a number of things, they're a homogenous population for the most part. They have some Korean and Chinese people that live there who like are distinctly still Korean or still Chinese.
Right, but the culture is thousands of years old.
The thing is that Japan, they do have low crime rates, but they also discourage people from reporting. So it's because it's part of like, oh, our community, this part of the town is going to be known as a crime area.
So it's the whole safe faith thing. So, that
yeah, because they,
they're known
because,
for. It's like, no,
yeah,
we
if,
can't.
Imagine, like, I mean, imagine if like you, like, it's really easy to apply, like, to understand what it's like to live in a homogenous population if you simply do this. Imagine if you, if your neighborhood was that big, was the size of a country. Imagine your neighborhood. Imagine everywhere you went felt like your neighborhood. That's what it's like. Because you feel accountable to everyone around you. You feel like they are member, you know what I'm saying? That they're near you, that they're, you know.
Wouldn't that be a good thing, though? Because that...
It generally is. I think it generally is. It generally
you take care
is.
Of each other. You're looking. Yeah. The village does raise the children, right?
But there are still people there. I mean, there's a lot of and that is because there's no locus of power in Japanese government, and that's because the government was set up by some generals in World War II. After World War II, which is really funny because they basically just wrote the entire Japanese constitution and like even used words. Like borrowed from the American, the U.S. Constitution, and and it's just really it's so funny. But
yeah, it's funny how we've infected all these other countries and populations under the guise of democracy, and it's really odd. It's corporatocracy that comes in and wants to manage the people and resources, and so there's profit over people and planet, and we need to flip that agenda to the people and planet over profit. How do we do that? What you're talking about is these. You know, creating these new networks and could be neural networks,
village networks,
could
yeah.
just, you know, be virtual networks. They could be physical networks.
Yeah.
The thing is, we've got to step up and be willing to do that or things aren't going to change.
Yeah. There's a lot of conflict right now. I think that we need to like not have conflict right now and we could sort out the conflict later, but right now we need to look for each other's virtues.
What makes us the same?
Yeah, what makes us the same, and their virtues, like we talked about it with the village thing, the support network is important, because like if someone is able to provide, for example, back in the day, a guy, the farrier, the guy who set up the horseshoes on the horses, let's say a guy had one horse, he didn't have his shoes, and he didn't have money to buy it, the guy would do it for him, so he could do his job, so he could do this thing that helps this other person, that needs their thing done, that helps this other person. It's a whole, and these things were so much easier to track and to respect and to appreciate back in the day, because you could follow the chain of custody of help, of cooperation that eventually, and it produced this product, something physical, generally. And but nowadays it's you send an email and some fact, like a guy who's a floor manager at a plant in Taiwan tells his people, you know what I'm saying? You don't, it's just not the same.
And yet we're, the communication is still, you know, you brought up I have a friend that used to manage 50,000 programmers for IBM in that same way. It was all very few virtual meetings. It was all done with email and online communications. And that it can be effective, but man, you've got to be really crystal clear in your communications in order to have things done. Now, again, you're also relying on the skill set and understanding of the person doing the work. So you're going to be able to speak the same language, but we don't all speak the same language, right? We've got to be able to navigate through. As an educator, I taught high school for a number
of years. We don't all speak the same language, but we all seek the same language. Does that make sense?
And I think that language is simply to love and be loved.
That's right. That's right. To be understood and to understand. That's and yeah, that's the language was birthed for that reason. It's that I think that language is a reflection of our most noble virtue, of the quality of us that's actually
Well, how we speak
worth
is
celebrating.
it gives evidence to the nature of who we are, right? Unless it, not unless it, that just it gives evidence to the nature of who we are and how we are impacted by external factors or internal factors in the way we speak. Now, not everybody can recognize that, right? We're not all cognitive scientists. And yet, we have the ability of slowing down and just being with that and sensing the moment rather than trying to think our way through it, which is the situation that you're in. And it causes, you know, the consternation and self-activated behaviors that aren't necessarily the best, or most conducive to developing relationships. How do you see this being a factor in personal development today and taking this situation that we're in? You know, you mentioned having to find your own way now as an entrepreneur. Many people are finding themselves in that situation, especially coming out of COVID. I think it's a silver lining in effect because it gives people the power to actually be who they are and to do.
Yeah, reflection, self-reflection is never a bad thing.
Right.
You know, unless you're doing it to be harmful, you cannot possibly conceive of a better way to spend your time if you're trying to improve yourself. It's like to honestly reflect. You know, you're right. I tell you, you'll write no truth if you lie to yourself. You'll live no truth if you lie to yourself. No.
Well, that's, excuse me, one of the phrases I use is there's, I like the
Kevin.
Trinity fractal, right?
Kevin.
I see
Kevin.
it in everything, you know, faith, love, and trust, and that is one of them. And then I have another that's attention, intention, and interaction as far as what we focus on. And it comes out of, you know, ancient wisdom, the gut, the heart and the head, as far as our processing, how we sense things with the gut, how we resonate with it in our heart, whether it's desirable or undesirable, and then what we do with it in the choices we make through our mental activity. And that's the last place that we need to process from, not the first. And we tend to process from our heads first. And then shove it all down through our body and wonder why we don't feel good. How do you see your own processes, how you internalize information, distill it, and then respond to it?
Well, like anything else, some what like for example, like whatever you do in life, everything you do, your profession, there's something in the center of it that everything else orbits, a purpose, right? That why do you do this thing? And it's right in the middle. It's about honoring that or creating that, and then and making sure that like whenever you recognize that it's signaling that it needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah, the pause, and you hit the pause button and self-reflect and see, okay, where am I at with this? Now, do you find that the speed of which we are expected to respond is a detriment to the evolution of this ability we have to self-reflect?
Yeah, I think that humans haven't quite adapted to the notion that we're not really in danger in the same way, right? And so, yeah, information doesn't need to be like moved through humans as fast as it used to be. Well, it is. We don't have to relay it as fast because the journey for it to get to the person, and its complete form, in a form that can be understood and replicated. That happens almost instantaneously now. So there's no running 6 miles to go tell, hey, our freaking barn burned down. So could you come? Yeah, and that took like 2 hours to do. Yeah, that took 2 hours to get there. So you lost 2 hours. You know what I'm saying? You don't have to do that anymore. We should be more thoughtful. Yeah, in the way we can. I hate texting for that reason. I ironically love writing. I'm a writer and I adore it more than anything. But I hate texting. It's something. So it's like trying to breathe underwater. You know what I mean? I don't know why.
Yeah, and purposeful, you know, when you're writing, you're communicating en masse, basically. When you're texting, you're communicating with an individual, and depending on the words you use, how they take it in, right? There can be so many different interpretations of, you know, 4 or 5 words.
Yeah.
And it's just, I hear you, it's excruciating. And people will usually look at a text from a potential disconnect first. They'll look at it in a fear-based mindset. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you know, especially if it's in a hurried fashion or you need something really quick, there tends to be a reaction rather than this. I love the new catchphrase, right? Slow down to go fast.
Oh yeah, there's in the military, it's hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Wait, slow down to go fast. That was the opposite. I'm saying the other way. You're saying that you slow down so that you move like smoothly and efficiently and
right. When you reliably. Slow down, you take in what's going on around mm-hmm. you much more effectively, and mm-hmm. you can interact with it even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And that eliminates all the distractions and the deterrents to the flow,
mm-hmm.
which generally, if you don't pay attention to stuff, you got all kinds of distractions and tangents that you got to go off on to fix stuff, mm-hmm. crisis management, right? Mm-hmm. That then slows you down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I remember I've got a couple of master's degrees in business, and in both programs, there was the mention of time. And in my MBA, there was even a quadratic formula to determine how long it would take you to get a specific task done, right? Project, whatever. And the rule of thumb, strangely enough, was it's going to take you 3 times as long as you think it will.
Mm-hmm.
So that landed pretty hard. It's like, okay. So that means there's all kinds of distractions in place that you have to navigate through that's going to take you that extra time to get the stuff done if they weren't there.
Yeah.
So what do? Well, you step back a little bit and say, okay, now let's examine this process a little bit more and make sure that we've got everything uncovered that could be a possible detriment
mm-hmm.
and have solutions for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's done in construction all the time. I ran partnering workshops for building road and construction for 20 years. One mm-hmm. of the processes, let's look ahead, see where the issues are going to be, because schedules mm-hmm. are usually 2 to 5 years for those size of projects.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at when these things are going to occur, what we need to have in place when they do, so that there's no work stoppage.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up being, you know, that much more of an efficient team.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see things like that as part of your own process of looking at, okay, what do we need to do, and what are the things that might impede it, and how can I resolve those before they happen? And especially in this thoughtmospheric cycle or cyclone that you might be in from time to time, right?
It's so funny. You
analyze things that way.
The amount of discipline it takes to do like what you're talking about, it's really funny because it because you know what it is. Like even like having a show and doing all this, it requires a lot of discipline. And it can be difficult to generate that. But the trouble is, what you need to do is you need to inspire yourself. And there's really no alternative, actually. If you want, I write my book, and as I'm writing it, if it doesn't interest me, I'm gonna not write the way that I'm not. I have to change it, because that would be that I don't I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't write something that bores me. So I've literally deleted like thousands of words because I was like, ah, I just
Right.
I knew. And that's the thing. Most people are they see that if you I don't know if this is most people, but for me, because I was bullied so much and beaten so much, I had to be really I willing to be like accept the truth of my failure in so many ways. So like when I'm writing, I don't marry myself to any particular passage or anything like that, unless I know if I know it's good, then it's good. But
Right. So you're
if
like
I
a good
know that
editor that, right,
I can't
you know
edit
that
my
there
own
are
stuff.
two thirds of what you write you need to get rid of because
I had to
projects are.
rewrite. I wrote the first draft of my book. It was 162,000 words. I had to rewrite the entire book. The entire book. The only thing that stayed the same is a poem in the beginning of the book. And it's really
Well, good
cute,
for
but anyway.
you to have that tenacity.
Well, I had to read. Well, yeah, because I wanted to write a work of literature, and so I realized that there was literally zero prose in my book when I had written what essentially was like halfway between a script and a novel. And so I wrote the, so I had to rewrite. I rewrote the entire thing, and it took me more than a year and a half, I think.
Well, I hope you saved the file because you may
Oh,
go back to
I
that and
actually have
create a
a I yeah
screenplay on it.
I actually have a paper copy. No, it's awful. No, it had to be rewritten. No, the events, everything stayed the same in terms of events and everything, but it was much more developed emotionally and in terms of characters and things like that. But anyway, yeah, it's it, to be to do that work, you have to make yourself like you have to do something that inspires you. So kids, like whatever they if you want to get into writing, a lot of people who are have a lot of who are intelligent, they have trouble getting into it because they don't know what to say. The thing is, you have to be comprehensive. Like if you're intelligent, you get your the only thing that's going to inspire you is creating connections that are really that you think are that are unique and helpful and consequential. You know, something so observations that you come up with and you want to describe to people about the dynamics of the world, whatever it is. You have to, if you so like for me, I didn't really want to become a writer until I understood politics well enough that everything started to make sense. All the different events that all my life you understand like socially that you're pressed into, like your relationship with parents, family, your peers at school, all of these different events, these realities, you know, because they're right next to you. But politics exists like adjacent to life, right? It's in your mind, and it's remote. It's in different town halls, and it's in different government buildings all over the country.
Right.
And so in that sense, it's until you can put those two components together, life and politics, you're not it's it and I don't mean politics like stuff that's petty. I mean truly consequential stuff, like
Yeah,
we're talking about
how
like
we do
voting
actually organize
rights.
and
Yeah,
administrate.
exactly. Yeah, so that everything every, yeah you have to be able to do those things. So like if you want to be a writer and you feel like you've got something going on upstairs, you can you should do that. You should study and learn about the world around you, because that's the only way you're going to find it interesting.
Super. Great insights, Christoph. Now we're coming kind of close to the end, and I want to ask a little more personal question. For folks like you, what kind of advice would you offer to help them move forward in their own lives?
Forgiveness. You have to forgive yourself. the one thing, the radical truth that I had to accept, even recently, is that whatever you've done in life, that whether you're not proud of, whether you feel like you failed in some sense, what or you feel insufficient or deficient in some way towards the people around you, you have to forgive yourself, because if you're trying to live in good faith and you're trying to be a good, you make it right as best you can. That's you live, if you live by that, that will survive any onslaught. I mean, if you can think about it, there are two options. You can either come to terms, like, with your anxiety, the things that make you anxious and all that stuff, or you die. Those are your two things. So this is the radical truth, is that you make it right as best you can. That's it. If you live that way, if you think about, that's what you have to do. That's it. That's what.
Awesome. Perfect. Thank you so much for your time, Christoph. I really appreciate you giving it, and the eloquence in which you had in explaining things to our audience. And I just really enjoyed that, and enjoyed the conversation with you as well. And much success to you
in your
continued efforts. All right.
Excellent. Yeah.
Cool. And namaste and in Laketch. And thanks for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and I will see you next time.